And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm probably going to finish the novel that I've been reading now for about 10 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. And if we have time, I will begin a brand new novel. So today's pretty exciting, but first, let's begin today's program with a picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The Different Tree, and then it's Many Shapes of Clay, A Story of Healing, Tia Fortuna's New Home, A Jewish-Cuban Journey, Kitty Bunkport, Wren's Nest, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Nico Draws a Feeling. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled The Different Tree. There was always something different about that tree. Every autumn, she looked like the others, bright, bold color bursting from her branches. But when fall's light faded and winter's shadow swept the dead leaves off the other trees, she held on. There was always something different about that tree, so stubborn whispered the wind. What's she waiting for? Wondered the birds perched on the bare bones of her neighbors. Let's go already, lamented the ground waiting to welcome her fallen leaves. Still, she held on. The other trees, too, weighed in. Doesn't she know the season has changed? Time's up, move on. Doesn't she know the rules? Clinging to her dried, dead, dangling leaves, as the days grew darker and the nights grew colder, she began to wonder herself, why am I holding on? She asked the birds, but they were busy finding shelter among the clusters of her crinkled leaves. She asked the buds, but they couldn't hear her under the cover of their protective brown blankets. She asked the leaves themselves, but they were gathering snow to seep into their veins and quench the tree's thirst over the coming winter. And so, without any answers, she held on. She just knew it wasn't time. She wasn't finished. There was always something different about that tree. And then the days began to grow lighter, the nights began to grow warmer, and her leaves began to fall. They covered the soil beneath her in a nourishing layer of nutrients that would help her grow stronger just in time for spring. The birds that her brown leaves had sheltered all winter long from predators and piercing cold began chirping and cawing and calling out their seasonal songs of gratitude. And she listened. The delicate buds that her dark leaves had been protecting from freezing burst open from her branches in a bright, bold bouquet of green that could only come from a season of safety. And all at once, she understood. There was always something different about that tree. Many Shapes of Clay, A Story of Healing. This is Isha, and this is her cat, who loves to take long naps. This is Isha's mama. She works in a small studio inside the basement of their apartment where she makes shapes from clay. small shapes, tall shapes, even bumpy, colorful shapes. Isha asks her mama why she doesn't play with the shapes. Why do you leave them on the shelves? Well, it takes so much time and patience to make each shape, her mama explains. They are too fragile to play with. Mama slices off a chunk of clay like butter, then rolls it into a ball like dough and hands it to Isha. Isha stretches and smooths and rolls the cool clay in her hands. She doesn't know what she'll make today. Maybe I'll make a two-headed lizard with polka dots, she thinks to herself. One shape in particular makes Isha very happy. It reminds her of the day last summer when she and Papa picked a handful of lemons. She paints her shape the same bright yellow. All this hard work deserves a pause, Mama says. How about some fresh air? Sweat drips down from the top of her head to the tip of her chin. Mama misses Papa too. Outside, a summer breeze rustles through the neighborhood trees while the sun slowly sinks behind the buildings. Isha sits on the stoop and plays with her yellow shape. The whole neighborhood seems to be taking a pause, except for Miss Harrington from the flower market. She rides past with a backpack full of lavender. She waves at Isha as a sprig of lavender falls out of her backpack and floats down to the sidewalk. Isha wonders if Miss Harrington will notice the missing sprig when she gets home. And if she does, will she feel sad about it? As Isha sits on the stoop, she imagines so many things she could do with her shape. Maybe we'll go to the beach someday, Isha says to herself. The sound of the ocean hugging the shore as water cooled her toes would feel so good. The rumble of a skateboard interrupts Isha's daydream. She looks down at her shape. It's less yellow now, like the color of a lemon that's lost its taste and not as soft. But that's okay, because now it makes music when Isha taps it with her fingers. Tap, 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 Isha taps her clay. Tap, tap, crack. Isha's shape has broken into many shapes on the ground. Each shape reflects the sadness she feels. Isha tries to think of ways to put the pieces back together. Tape wouldn't last very long, and glue always sticks to the wrong things, like her hands. What Isha feels is hard to describe, like something that is too heavy to lift, like something that might last forever. The sunlight is fading, and the breeze has stopped blowing through the trees. Isha's eyes fill with tears as she looks down at all the broken pieces. What happened? Asks Mama as she scoops Isha up onto her lap. I gave my shape so much time and patience, but now it's in pieces, Isha says. It's okay to feel sad about those broken pieces, Mama says. There are times, many times, when we lose the things we love. Mama somehow knows what Isha is feeling. I never knew she could feel the same feelings, Isha thinks, and hugs her mama close. Together, they pick up the broken pieces and walk past the shapes on Mama's shelves, stepping over the last step where the cat purrs sound asleep. You can't always fix what's broken. But you can always try, Mama says as she pulls out a small box from under her bed. Inside are spindles of twine in different sizes, colors, and textures. Slowly, with patience and care, Mama and Disha connect all the broken pieces together by looping twine around each one until there is only one piece left. Maybe I can make it into something new tomorrow, Isha thinks out loud. What a wonderful idea, Mama says, gazing at Isha with a warm smile. Now let's wash up and see what we can come up with for dinner. Tia Fortuna's New Home, A Jewish-Cuban Journey. I love to visit my Tia Fortuna and her little pink Castilla at the Seaway. When my auntie was young, she lived on the other side of the sea in Havana. From her rooftop, she waved to the ships as they came into the harbor. But one day, Tia had to leave with nothing but a suitcase of old photographs and the mezuzah that hung on her doorpost and a key to a home gone forever. She felt lost and wept many tears until she found her casita at the Seaway. She has lived there for years and years. Today is Tia's last day at the Seaway. Why do you have to move, Tia? Bulldozers are coming to tear down the Seaway. A fancy hotel will be built here. What will happen to your little pink casita? My home will be a memory. Tia touches the key on her necklace, like the home I left in Havana. A memory. But I want to visit you at the Seaway today and next Friday and always. Australia, it's time to say goodbye and wish for Mazal Bueno. Tia gives me a hug and her lucky eye bracelets tinkle and twinkle. Come, Australia, vamos a sudar la playa. The beach wants to greet you. We kick off our sandals and breathe in the salty air. Look at that bright blue sky. The sun gives everyone its light for free. The sea roars all night, and now it's tickling our feet. Australia, written in the sand. Tia sinks down into the sand. What a pretty Castilla you're making, she says. How can Tia be happy on such a sad day? Tomorrow the sandcastle will be gone, and so will we. It's not mañana yet, Estrella. Let's enjoy today. When we get back to the Seaway, Tia serves me warm bouquets. How do you make borcas taste so delicious, Tia? I'll tell you my secret. I fill them with potatoes and cheese and esperanza. How can borcas be filled with hope? Because they are the food of your grandfathers, and your grandmothers. They took them from Spain to Turkey to Cuba. Now we eat them here in Miami. Tia smiles. We come from people who found hope wherever they went. Esperanza, 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 I say aloud, and I help Tia pack a box with the rest of the borcas. Is that all you're bringing with you, I ask? I don't need much, she replies. I have so many memories in my suitcase right here, and she points to her head. Mommy arrives, and she's in a rush. Wait, Tia says, I need my good luck mezuzah. But Tia's mezuzah is so crusted with sea salt, it won't budge. Finally, Tia asks, mezuzah, would you please come with me? And it pops out. Tia locks the door and slips the big brass key in her pocket. Goodbye, Miss Palmeras, goodbye, she whispers. Palm trees swooshing answer her. Adios, Adios, adios. We leave the sea behind and drive toward banyan trees and the butterflies. At the front gate, I feel Tia's hand tremble. Tia, where are we? La casa de los viejitos, Tia says. She leans against a banyan tree and runs her hands along its rooty trunk. Hello, glad to meet you. You've been here a while, haven't you? The banyan tree nods its head at Tia and says, Hola, hola, hola. We step inside and Tia says, Let's share the borcas with everyone we meet. Soon, they're all saying thank you. You're welcome, Tia replies, and makes new friends right away. The lady next door to Tia's room hears us speaking Spanish. I once lived by the port of Havana and waved to the ships, she says. So did I, Tia tells her. I'm glad we're neighbors. They laugh together like old friends. Mama carries in Tia's suitcase. I help nail the salty mezuzah to the new doorpost. I arrange Tia's pillows on her bed. Here's a good place for your photo albums, I say to Tia. Gracias, Estrellita. It's starting to feel so cozy already, Tia says. She gives me a hug, and her lucky eye bracelets tinkle and twinkle. Tia, next time I visit, we'll sit in the garden and watch the butterflies dance. Mashallah, God willing, Tia says. Until then, here's a gift for you, Estrella. She puts something cool in my palm and squeezes my hand around it. The key to the seaway. Look, Tia, I'll carry it with me always. And as soon as I slip the big brass key around my neck, I hear the sea laughing and smell the salty air. I can see the grandmothers and grandfathers from long ago carrying borcas from Spain to Turkey to Cuba to Miami. At the front gate, we watch the night spread its blanket over the world. Look, Tia, the first star is lighting up the darkness everywhere. Estrella, 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 she replies. Tia gives me a goodnight hug, and as I turn down the path, I whisper, Mazul Bueno, into the starry night. Kitty Bunkport. And this is a story where all the characters are cats. Chowder and Crackers loved being best friends in Kitty Bunkport. It was the perfect place to sit in the sun, nap, clean themselves, scratch stuff, stare at things, nap more, hack up hairballs, and of course, catch lobster. The only problem was they were terrified of the town's super haunted lighthouse that showed the way home to cats who'd been out catching lobster all day. Oh, I wouldn't say I'm terrified of it. I would. That's exactly what I would say. Two cats in a boat. That's why it was so troubling when the lighthouse suddenly turned off. Luckily, this didn't scare Chowder or Crackers or any of the other cats of Kitty Bunkport one bit. Ah, what do we do? This is so scary. We're all so super scared right now. I wouldn't say I'm super scared. I would. That's exactly what I would say. They had all heard the stories of how the lighthouse was haunted by the ghost of all the lobsters ever eaten, and how a couple of fluff balls went out there years ago and never returned. It was for this reason that not one scaredy cat in Kitty Bunkport raised their paw when the harbor master asked for volunteers to go see what was wrong, especially not Chowder and crackers. That's why it was so troubling when they were chosen. For the record, I thought about raising my paw. For the record, I did not. As they neared the lighthouse that night, Chowder and Crackers realized there wasn't anything to worry about. Other than everything, "Hey, Crackers, just want you to know that despite how my face looks and how all my fur is standing up and how much I'm shaking, I'm actually not scared at all. Okay, just so you know, I am more scared than I have ever been in my entire life." Inside the lighthouse, Chowder and Crackers were surprised to find it wasn't half as scary as they thought. It was way scarier. "I wouldn't say way scarier. That's exactly what I would say. Crackers is out of here." Chowder grabbed Crackers, and together they climbed through thick, very gross cobwebs up the lighthouse's creaky stairs. To keep Crackers calm, because Crackers was the only scared one, Chowder tried to talk about less scary things, things like the manner in which they each preferred to eat lobster. "I prefer my lobster on top of macaroni and cheese." "Interesting. I prefer my lobster in roll form." After reaching the top of the lighthouse, they both felt much better. That's why it was so troubling when a lobster ghost appeared. "Run, lobster ghost!" "It is. It's the ghost of a lobster that's definitely what it is." It wasn't. It was a dog holding a giant box that said, "Light bulb." "Do either of you have a ladder?" This is the dog. The reason I ask is because, as you can tell by the extremely yellow pants I'm wearing, I am a dog that fishes professionally. And I can't find my way back home without the lighthouse. So I anchored my very cool boat out there and came in to turn the light on. But I can't get high enough to change the light bulb." Chowder and Crackers needed to make sure the dog was telling the truth. First, they checked the dog's pants. They were indeed extremely yellow. Next, they checked the dog's boat. It was indeed very cool. Finally, they checked the light bulb. It was indeed very high and out of reach and not working. "We don't have a ladder, but we can make one. And just so you know, we only screamed before because we weren't scared of you." "Just so you know, I was very scared of you." As offered, Chowder and Crackers made a cat ladder to help the dog. First, Chowder formed a strong base. Next, Crackers climbed atop Chowder. Finally, the dog climbed them both. And just as their 12-pawed ladder was about to topple, the dog changed the light bulb. Leaving, Chowder and Crackers looked back at the blazing lighthouse and realized they would never be scared of it again. Dogs either. "Hey, dog, do you want to come back to Kitty Bunkport with us to grab some whoopie pies?" "Well, I should get back home, but if you ever travel up north, you should come visit." "Oh, yeah? Where do you live?" "Bark Harbor." When Chowder and Crackers returned, the cats of Kitty Bunkport treated them like heroes and let them eat all the lobster they could in exactly the manner in which they each preferred it. And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled Wren's Nest. When Wren was born, Grandpa put a wren box just outside the window of her tiny room. When she was a baby, the wrens sang her to sleep. Each spring, Wren and Grandpa watched the birds bringing sticks and grasses to the box and listened when the babies squealed for their dinner. Sammy Cat pressed her nose up to the window, and the daddy wren chat-chat-chatted a warning to get away. Wren and Grandpa watched out the window year after year. Grandpa told her stories about wrens, make-believe ones like Cinda-Wren-A, and real ones like how daddy wrens sometimes built two or three nests before finding the perfect spot for mama wren to lay eggs. When she got big enough, Grandpa brought Wren her very own pair of binoculars. They watch birds in the meadow behind the house, bluebirds and blue jays, robins and mockingbirds, nuthatches and chickadees. Sometimes a red-tailed hawk would circle lazily over the meadow and all the other birds scattered. The wrens, though, were her favorites. Then, one spring, Wren's family moved from their tiny house to a bigger one, squished in between two other houses. Mama and Daddy decided it was perfect. Wren wasn't so sure. Grandpa told her not to worry. He hung a new wren box outside her new window. No new wrens moved in. The new house felt big and lonely. Mama and Daddy went to their new jobs, and Grandpa was busy building things. Wren sat on the front porch and looked through her binoculars. She spotted a boy riding his bike, a pair of joggers, and a dog sniffing a fire hydrant. And she saw pigeons. Only pigeons. Discouraged, Wren sat quiet and alone in the corner of the porch. A little gray bird startled her when it flew in and sat on the railing. It was so close, Wren didn't even need her binoculars. Flit, 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 flit went its tail. "P.B., P.B.," the bird called. "P.B., P.B.," and just like that, it was gone. Wren stood to see where the Phoebe had flown off to, but what she saw was even better. Up high, where she had not looked before, pressed in between the porch beam and the house wall, was a nest. Wren climbed quietly and carefully onto the railing to get a peek inside. She had to stand on her tiptoes, but in that nest, she saw five perfect eggs. Phoebe eggs. She couldn't wait to tell Grandpa. Every day, Wren sat on the porch quietly. Sometimes, Grandpa joined her. One sunny afternoon, one of them, then quickly all five hatched. When she peeked, Wren couldn't really tell where one chick ended and another began. Soon, right from her corner on the porch, Wren could see the chick's beaks poking out of the top of the nest. Mama and Daddy Phoebe flew in treats for the babies, who always seemed to be hungry. The chick's feathers were growing quickly, and their wings started to sprout. Sometimes they tested their new wings, sometimes their tails. Flit, 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 flit. They got so big they barely fit into the nest anymore. Mama laughed and patted her belly when Wren told her this. Grandpa finished his project on the morning the Phoebes fledged. He and Wren sat on the porch, quietly together watching the birds. First one chick leaned over the edge, flapping its now full-grown wings. Like magic, they lifted him into the air and he flew. Then a second followed. For a while, the three remaining Phoebes seemed to want to stay in the new roomy nest. But then two more fledged at almost the same time. The last Phoebe stayed a little longer until just before lunchtime. Suddenly, the nest was empty and silent. Wren thought she would miss those baby Phoebes. But the very next day, Mama brought home a very special baby Phoebe. Oh, and it's a baby named Phoebe. Grandpa helped Wren move Phoebe's crib over to the window. Someday, Wren knew she would teach her little sister all about birds. But for now, Wren was happy to watch this baby Phoebe grow in their new house that was big enough for them both. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue and possibly finish the novel that I've been reading now for almost 10 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week, after Darcy said goodbye at the airport and walked through security, while on the escalator leading to her gate, she turned around and decided to run back to Russell, who was still waiting there for her. And that's where I left off last week. Chapter 24, Monday, 10:40 p.m. "Russell," I yelled as I ran through the airport. And I didn't even mind that it was a trope from my favorite movies. They weren't a good blueprint for basing your life off of, I knew that now. But it was clear to me that they'd gotten one thing right. When someone's about to slip away, possibly forever, you do what you can to get them back, even if it's running through the airport, especially if it's running through the airport. I saw Russell just outside the sliding glass doors, walking away, and I picked up my pace, stepping back out into the cool California night. "Russell! Darcy?" He turned, his brow furrowed, and walked toward me. "Is everything okay?" "Yes." "And also no. I closed the space between us and looked at him, seeing all the variations at once. All the Russells I'd known over the last day. Russell sharing my pillow, reaching over to stroke my cheek, lifting my suitcase out of the car, refusing to let me help, reading to me as we drove across the Nevada desert, helping me change a tire, patient and joking the whole time. walking in the moonlight, holding a small, tired dog. Fighting with me outside his dad's office, both of us yelling, neither one of us backing down. Crossing the football field in step with me. A bag of tacos under his arm. And finally, the stranger in the bus station. The cute boy who'd heard I'd been looking for him. I took a deep breath and reached up to touch his face, my hands on either side of it. I don't want this to be goodbye. A smile flashed across Russell's face like lightning, just as bright, gone just as quickly. Me either, he said, but you actually did make some good points. Why did you say actually? I asked in a tone of faux outrage, and he laughed. Well, about what this year is going to look like for us. I know, I said. I dropped my hands and twisted them together and got my courage up. All I could do was ask. If he said no, he said no. But at least I would have tried. But what if we didn't have to decide right now what it's going to be? Russell looked at me, his eyebrows raised. I took a breath and went on. How about this? We're not in touch for the next few months. We live our own lives. We do our own thing. We're not tied to anything. But if we're still feeling this way, we'll meet back at the bus station in Jesse in December over Christmas break. And if we both show up there, we'll know we should give it a try. But we won't be holding ourselves back or trying to stretch something out. And if only one of us or neither of us shows up, we'll know it wasn't meant to be, and no hard feelings. Russell had started to smile. He tilted his head to the side. Isn't this from a movie? I said, looking down and tucking my hair behind my ear. Possibly. Isn't it Before Sunrise? Maybe, I said, wanting to move past this, but it's an affair to remember. And Sleepless in Seattle, too. There's a long tradition. But didn't all those take place before people could, you know, text each other? I kind of like the idea, I pointed out as I searched Russell's face, trying to discern what he was feeling. No communication, he said slowly, thinking it over. Jesse bus station in December. The 21st, I asked, just picking a date at random. 6 o'clock? Russell shook his head. I have something at 6. Can we shift it? I started to reply, then realized a second later he was kidding. What do you think? He took a step closer to me, cupping my chin in his hand. I'm in, if you are. I stretched up to kiss him, just as he bent down to kiss me. And I didn't care that we were in public or possibly blocking the doors to the airport. I needed this kiss to be the bridge between now and 3 months from now, giving me something to hold on to. We broke apart after a while. I'd truly lost all sense of time, and I pulled my phone out of my pocket and groaned, I really have to go. You have a flight to catch, he said, smiling down at me, and a world to conquer. I smiled at him. Well, maybe I'll see you in a few months. Or not. Jesse bus station, December 21st, 6 o'clock. I'll see you then. I kissed him one more time, then stepped away. We were still holding hands, and I gave his a squeeze, holding it for one more beat before I let go. It's not a goodbye, Russell said, shaking his head. It's a see you later. I smiled at that. I wondered if he felt like I did, suddenly a little bit lighter. I knew that this plan wasn't perfect, and a million things could, and probably would, happen before December. But for now, it felt like the right thing to do. It would mean I could move forward, not feeling like I'd made a huge mistake, or committed myself too quickly, but like we'd actually have time to figure out what we wanted. "See you later," I echoed. He gave me a smile and a nod, and I gave him one back. And then there was nothing left to do but go. I turned and walked back up the stairs toward the security line, tempted to take them two at a time, feeling a buoyancy in my step, still tasting Russell's kiss on my lips. When I reached the top, I turned around. I could still see him, but barely through the glass doors. They were sliding open and shut. I saw him through the crowds, and the doors and the distance meet my eye. He raised a hand in a wave, and I raised one back. I stood there for just a second longer, memorizing this moment, and then I turned and walked forward toward whatever the future would bring. And here's the final chapter, chapter 25, Friday, December 21st, 5:45 p.m. I pulled into a space in the Jesse bus terminal lot and shifted the Prius into park. As I'd gotten out closer to Jesse and the temperature had dropped, I'd seen that the mountains that surrounded the town were now snow-capped and stunningly beautiful, making it both familiar and completely different. The lot wasn't hugely full. A smattering of cars and trucks, the occasional van, and a motorcycle parked right by the entrance. I looked around for the Bronco before I realized a second later that, of course, Russell wouldn't have been driving it. But I actually had no idea what he would be driving. I tilted the rearview mirror down and ran a brush through my bangs. Chloe had been right. They worked on my face, and I really liked them a lot. But it was the highest maintenance haircut I'd ever had, something I was still getting used to. But Dee Dee and Katie both loved it. I'd FaceTime them right after I'd left Visible Change, the salon in Stanwich that Jillian had recommended. In the first few days after I'd gotten to the Stanwich campus and met Mirabella, my very flaky roommate, she would go on to drop out after 20 days, leaving me with the inevitable position of being a freshman with a single, even though I was assured by the housing office that this would not be the case second semester. I found myself checking my phone a little too often, always hoping to see a message from Russell that he had decided to forego our agreement and reach out. And at first, the silence did bother me in a low-hum kind of way, in the background but still present. But this really didn't last long because there was a lot going on. I had to get my class schedule and navigate the campus and try to make friends and sort out the dining hall etiquette and get a handle on my hair, which was encountering sustained humidity for the first time ever. And more than anything else, I was figuring out what a relationship with my mother looked like. For the first time since I was quite tiny, we were in the same place at the same time. And it wasn't like things had been easy. The ride when she'd picked me up from JFK had not been a great start. I'd been exhausted from barely sleeping on the plane, in addition to my emotional hangover from the previous 24 hours with Russell. We were stilted and awakened with each other until, unprompted, Jillian pulled off the highway and into a McDonald's drive-thru. I got a sausage, egg, and cheese McMuffin. She got a McGriddle. And we both got hash browns and coffee. We drove the rest of the way with the bag on the seat between us, eating in silence. But not super strained silence, more like we were just getting our bearings. We started with a once-a-week coffee date on campus that then grew to include a standing Sunday dinner at her house. "That's so Gilmore Girls," Dee Dee had groaned. "You're even in Connecticut." On the nose much? These dinners meant I was also getting to know my half-siblings. And even Anthony a little, though he still seemed to travel a lot for work, going back to the UK pretty frequently. So he was only there around half the time. It was a strange concept, essentially meeting three people that I was related to. We were easing into what our relationship could look like. So far, it involved watching a lot of animated movies and playing a needlessly complicated board game about building railroads. We didn't yet have the kind of relationship that Russell had had with his half-siblings, but it was a start, and for now, that was enough. I knew what Jillian and I had didn't look like a traditional mother-daughter relationship, and maybe it never would. But we were finding out what it looked like for us, and maybe that was all that was needed. We were just taking it one coffee date, one dinner, one conversation, and text exchange at a time, rebuilding our bridge slowly so that it would be strong enough to withstand a storm if the weather got rough again. And it wasn't like my dad had been absent from all of this. My first day on campus, we'd had a very long conversation in which I told him everything, the bus station and Russell and the helicopter and Wiley Sanders and staying in the guest house and the road trip home. He had not been happy about this, to say the least, but he did seem somewhat mollified when a huge box of Nighthawks merchandise had shown up at the house, including a note from Wiley that was addressed to Ted. My dad wrote him back a thank you, which led, in a twist I truly hadn't seen coming, to my dad and Wiley becoming friends. They'd started hanging out whenever Wiley was in California, going on hikes and to baseball games, and there was talk of my dad going out to see him at the Wynn. I heard from Montana occasionally. She was always sending me Connecticut recommendations and funny memes. She was supportive of our dads becoming buddies, telling me that her dad needed a friend his own age. And when I pointed out that my dad was 20 years younger than Wiley, she waved this off, calling it rock star math. And not only did my dad have a new, burgeoning friendship with Wiley, he was also no longer alone in our house. He'd sent me a picture in late September, him holding up a yellow-white puppy with a squashed face and huge paws. It turned out the dog had been a rescue hired for one of my dad's ads campaigns, and he'd fallen in love with him on set, especially when the dog refused to take any sort of direction and ended up toppling the craft services table, then joyfully eating the spoils that hit the ground. He'd taken the dog home that night, just calling him the name of the product as a stopgap, even though I'd told my dad in no uncertain terms not to do this in case the dog got attached to it. Which, of course, he did. So now we were stuck with it. And while my first instinct was to be mad about the fact that I hadn't had a dog my whole childhood and that my dad got one basically the second I was out of the house, I was just so won over by his cute face and high-pitched bark and wappy tail, it was impossible to be mad. The dog was so cute that with all the updates and pictures I was getting, it had taken all my self-control not to clean out my savings and book a flight home immediately to cuddle him. But my dad assured me that he would be there waiting for me when I came home for Christmas. And when I'd finally met him 3 days earlier, Zytek, the dog, had more than lived up to expectations. I gave my bangs one last brush, then dropped the brush into my purse, My heart was starting to beat a low, steady pulse in my throat. I wasn't nervous. I was excited. Because unless something had gone very wrong in the last few hours, I knew Russell would be there. I had thought, as we'd moved into October, and I got my first glimpse of the wonder that is fall in New England, that this would just be it, that we would keep to the terms of our agreement and have no communications until December. And Russell had faded out slightly from the forefront of my mind. I made friends. I took weekend trips into New York City. I found that I loved my sociology professor and hated everything about statistics. I fell hard for East Coast bagels, and I inadvertently got into a feud with my RA when I left a note on their whiteboard that accidentally led their girlfriend to figure out they were cheating. So there was a lot going on. And when, on a random Tuesday, I opened my inbox, I wasn't at all expecting to see an email from Russell with the subject line, "The Ballad of Darcy and Russell." It was lyrics to a song about two people finding each other against the odds, connecting over one night, going their separate ways, but always thinking of each other, usually at the same time, though they didn't realize it, thousands of miles apart. It was beautiful, even without being able to hear the music, just reading the lyrics. I felt tears spring to my eyes. I called Russell immediately, and he answered on the second ring, and I hadn't realized until that moment just how much I'd missed hearing his voice. And we started a marathon phone call that lasted all that afternoon. I decided I didn't really need to go to statistics, and into the evening, talking on the phone, headphones in, curled up on my bed, as it got later and later. And I was beyond grateful, once again, that Marabella was gone, and I didn't have to do this while pacing around the quad or in one of the soundproof cubbies in the library. It turned out that Russell had deferred Michigan after all. He was bouncing between L.A. with his mom and Nevada with his dad as he worked on his musical adaptation of Theus's Sailboat. But the Darcy and Russell song was a one-off. He told me he hadn't been able to stop thinking about it until he got it down on paper. I told him about my friends and my classes and the escalating feud with my RA, and it was like we were picking up where we'd left off. We could have been walking around Jesse or driving in his dad's Bronco or sitting with bags of well-done fries in front of us. Finally, I had to hang up to go to sleep. But as we said goodbye, I knew this wouldn't be the end of things. And I was right. As October moved into November, we fell into a routine. We would have long conversations on the phone, usually at night. We had an open text thread that we just kept going. The perfect place to drop in an observation or a meme or a picture of Tidbit and Andy. And as we shared stories and observations in our daily minutiae, I actually got to know him. Got to know him in a way that you can't in 24 hours, no matter how jam-packed they are. I knew which emojis he liked, which Spider-Man meme he would inevitably send, and how his voice sounded at night when he was sleepy and talking to me with his eyes closed. I got to learn about his day-to-day, and he did the same with me. And as we moved into the middle of November, it was crazy to realize that I thought I'd known him back in August, because while I'd gotten a sense of him, it was still just the outline. But we were filling in the rest now. One late-night conversation, one text exchange, one FaceTime chat at a time. So, it probably shouldn't have been a surprise when Russell mentioned that his dad was going to be back in New York in November, and maybe... But what did surprise me was how quickly I said no. Even though we'd broken every other part of our engagement, I wanted to keep our December meeting as it was. You want us both to drive separately to Nevada, all the way from California, and meet at a bus station? Russell had asked me, incredulous, when I'd put the kibosh on a November meeting. You're going to be coming from your dad's, I pointed out. You only have to drive 3 hours. I'm the one who has to drive 7 hours. But neither of us has to drive any hours. We can just meet in L.A. And while I knew that made a lot of sense, I held the line. I liked the romance of it, even though I knew that he would be there waiting for me. I wanted the road trip to meet the boy I'd been separated from. The drive across the desert as night started to fall, the reconnecting in a place we'd first met. Russell finally agreed, and November continued apace. My dad flew out for Thanksgiving. He stayed in a hotel, but we had Thanksgiving dinner at Jillian and Anthony's. It was something that I wouldn't have believed could even be possible a few months ago. But there we all were, sitting around a table, passing the gravy and arguing over whether marshmallows belonged in sweet potatoes. I was a resounding yes. And before the month was over, I got another equally ground-shaking surprise. Russell sent me a link to a song, the Darcy and Russell song, with Wiley singing it. It was a little pre-holiday present just for me. There weren't any plans to release it, and it was just for the three of us, which made it all the more special. And ever since he'd sent it, I'd been listening to it pretty much nonstop. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I'm going to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want everyone to... tune in next week when I guarantee you that I will finish this book and begin a brand new novel. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.